Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. John Dean once served in the highest ranks of a Republican administration as counsel to President Richard Nixon. Dean witnessed the abuse of executive power up close. He helped orchestrate the Watergate cover-up, but later turned key witness for the prosecution. Now in a new book, he finds fault with the current administration and claims Republicans, from those in the White House to those on Capitol Hill, have severely damaged the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of our government. His book is titled Broken Government. John Dean joins me in the studio, and we'll take your calls throughout the hour. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. John Dean, it's good to see you again.
It's always good seeing you.
Thank you. You say in the subtitle, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Do you really believe destroyed is the appropriate word?
I think it is for this reason. They so moved the different branches from the fundamental constitutional concepts, underlying them, and until they're pushed back into the constitutional framework, they're broken branches. I didn't do a litany of everything that has gone wrong. Rather, I sort of focused on very fundamental, basic, well-understood processes and procedures that the Republicans have just found they really can't accept. And I use the word rule, Republican rule, deliberately because I find a great difference between governing and ruling. And I think they're very good at ruling and not very good at governing, which happens to surprise me.
It's interesting. I found myself wondering whether people would accept these kinds of statements and, if you will, accusations coming from you. You who were so involved, first in the cover-up and then in the exposure of Watergate.
Well, as you know, and those who will look at the book will know, this is really a third in a trilogy where I've looked at sort of post-Watergate Republican operations in Washington. And I've been somewhat surprised that what we did and the mistakes we made have now become something of the norm of governing and a part of the conservative canon. So I don't think people are going to be surprised that I'm saying these things. And in both the prior books, nobody refuted anything I had to say in those, and I don't believe they can refute anything I've said here because I'm basing it on fact.
Explain a little more when you say what you all did back then has now become, as you say, part of the Republican canon.
Diane, we wrote the book on what not to do. We made a lot of mistakes. There were abuses of presidential power that the American people found. They found they were not acceptable. The so-called imperial presidency that Richard Nixon built on top of Lyndon Johnson's presidency, they said, this isn't what we want. There was a readjustment of the of the separation of powers and the balance and checks that exist in the system in the post-Watergate years. And I thought that was healthy. I, as somebody who was on the inside, realized the enormous power the president has, what he can do, and what he can do even if he's not a particularly popular. While Nixon did win his elections big, with inside the Beltway, he wasn't very popular. Mm-hmm. But still, just the raw power of the that the president holds in his hands, the levers he can pull, the buttons he can push, the ability to dictate the agenda, if you will, give him tremendous power. Well, in the post-Watergate years, people like Dick Cheney, who's now vice president, of course, believed that what happened is that the Congress and the courts so weakened the presidency that it was time to strengthen it. Well, as I take apart in this book, that's a fallacious argument. That is absolutely untrue. By the time Reagan left, the imperial presidency was back. In fact, Bill Clinton was accused by many conservatives of running an imperial presidency. But now what they've done in the presidential branch, in the executive branch, is they've sort of taken the imperial presidency and put it up on stilts and then given it a shot of steroids and made it something they call a unitary executive, or operating under unitary executive theory, that is truly frightening to me and somebody who knows how these things can get out of hand.
Vice President Cheney is very much a part of this book. You feel, in fact, that he has orchestrated this this movement toward this unitary presidency.
I do. I think that Bush was sympathetic to it. I've found in some of my research that people who went down to Texas and say in 1998, when Bush was starting to think about running for president, they found books like Terry Eastland's book called Executive Energy, which is the new conservative canon to take the executive branch and increase the power of the presidency as being basic conservative philosophy.
Give me an example of how that would come about.
Well, I guess the most
be demonstrated.
Yeah, the most familiar example would be something like signing statements where you tell the people which laws you will and which laws you will not enforce.
But doesn't every president have that right?
They do, but never to the degree that's been done.
Give me comparisons.
Well, I saw data once that Bush has issued more signing statements than all presidents, the prior 42 presidents that have existed. And he's done it about the time he ended his first term. So that's sort of a paper in your face, here's what I'm going to do. What they're doing, though, is they're issuing executive orders. They're using the power of the pen. They're repealing acts of Congress with executive orders. They're not getting taken to court on it because the courts are sympathetic with what they're doing. And these are the ways, just day by day, in little incremental moves, they are enhancing the presidential powers, the likes of which we've never seen before.
John Dean, his new book is titled Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. There are an awful lot of people out there who are going to accuse you of having written a strictly partisan book.
Well, they may accuse me, but they will be incorrect. I don't carry water for either party. I, in many ways, still consider myself a Goldwater conservative. I actually am doing a book about the senator right now and going through his papers. And Barry Goldwater today would be considered a liberal. That's how far things have moved to the right. He's somebody who respected the separation of powers. I'm a partisan for one thing, and that's good government. As somebody who saw government go astray from the inside and realized how dangerous and troublesome that can be, I have a certain appreciation that the public doesn't often know. And actually, people within the Beltway, if they know, they don't want to talk about it when things are not working as they're supposed to. You know, Diane, one of the interesting things, when I first started this book, I found a poll, and then CNN ran that poll last November before the 2006 election that showed 3 out of 4 Americans believe their government is broken. They can't always articulate why. That's what this book does, is tell them why that intuitive feeling they have about things being wrong, and they're very good at sensing when they are wrong, are in fact off the track.
Why do you believe, or do you believe, that Democrats did not fight back hard enough to ensure that the kinds of things that you're talking about in this book didn't happen?
Well, when after the Republicans took control of Capitol Hill, by the time they'd been there about 2.5-3 years, they had so changed the operations on Capitol Hill, they'd removed the traditional chairman as being senior members with experience to people who would respond to Speaker Gingrich or Speaker Hastert later. They had eliminated the deliberative process. They had closed rules on the floor of the House where there was no debate. They ran it in a very dictatorial way.
Are you saying that Democrats were powerless?
Well, the Democrats did become powerless. In fact, what's interesting now that they control the Congress is their inability to do anything. And a lot of people are saying that's because they don't have the will. I think they have the will and the desire, but they're running against very effective obstruction techniques. The filibuster is a very powerful tool. The House has passed an awful lot of important legislation. It's now stymied by the Senate, by the threat of filibuster. And this is a very good tool to make it appear that the Democrats can't run the place either. This is how Republicans won in 94.
John Dean, his new book is titled Broken Government, and you can join us with your questions and comments. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back. John Dean is with me, and of course you know his name as the former counsel to President Nixon. He participated in the Watergate cover-up and then became a witness for the prosecution. He's now writing passionately about something he feels has happened not only here in Washington, but across the country. His new book is titled Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. one quick email here from Diane in Cleveland, Ohio. Just out of curiosity, she says, is John still married to Maureen? They are a handsome couple.
Indeed, we're very much married. And, you know, that's interesting. That question is probably everywhere I've gone over the last few years now that I've been back out writing books again. People are curious. They remember her very well from the Senate hearings. She's not writing anymore. She enjoys her privacy. But she, as people who read my books know in the acknowledgement, she's the one that prevents me from making them too textbookish. She says, John, everybody's got to be able to understand this stuff. So she, when I get to the final manuscript, she gives her final approval on it.
And here's another email from Bryce in Salt Lake City, Utah. Please ask your guest, what, if any, actions by the current administration he would qualify as criminal?
As criminal? Well, we don't, for example, we don't know what happened in the U.S. attorney firing. That is very troublesome. That comes very close to obstruction of justice. If they're removing U.S. attorneys to control prosecution, that's a very troublesome potential. The first one I spotted, though, to go way back, were the misrepresentations made to Congress by the administration, by the president right on down, about going to war in Iraq. There were clearly false statements made, statements that from the internal evidence you can tell that they knew they weren't giving the Congress the information that they had, that Congress could make a very intelligent and fully disclosed decision. Well, that's a crime. That's an unlawful act. In fact, that's one of the few things that the founders addressed as being a high crime and misdemeanor would be to not inform the Congress the reasons for war. That's about as serious as you can get. But there are, as the various oversight hearings are now going on, and they will continue until Mr. Bush leaves, I think we're going to see a lot of troublesome areas for these people.
Troublesome, but is a democratically controlled Congress likely to carry that as far as, say, impeachment?
Well, I think Bush is the beneficiary of a number of situations that happened by Republicans attacking Clinton. The impeachment, for example, has been probably taken off the table by Speaker Pelosi because of the abuse that was made of that process when Clinton was in office. It was purely political. They were harassing him. They didn't like him, and rather than try to weaken the presidency, they tried to weaken the president, and they used every tactic they could use. Excuse me. There was an independent counsel law, which has now expired. Since both parties have been pretty well gored by that law, I don't think, while it was an important law, it's going to be revised. But there probably have been a half a dozen instances that would be under investigation today, indeed, if there was an independent counsel law. So, you know, to accuse somebody of a crime is pretty serious. So I'm very reluctant to do that, although I am very suspicious of an awful lot of activity.
You devote several pages of your book to the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, and you talk about how its passage exemplifies Republican methods of running Congress. Explain what you're talking
about.
Well,
one of the things that struck me is quite quite incredible is there's long been a tradition of both, in fact, it's not a tradition, it's the nature of the Constitution, where both bodies have to agree upon identical legislation before it's sent to the president for approval. When there has been when there was a change in the law that was in the Senate that was really a $2 billion mistake that went from the Senate to the House, the House did not embrace the mistake, but rather they put the money back in, which happened to deal with some Medicare funding for permanent sort of things like wheelchairs and things like this. they put it in, and when it went over to the Senate clerk struck it back out, and they sent it down to the president, and the speaker was aware of this, just rolled over, and it was not the bill the House had passed. Now, typically, these things happen all the time in the legislative process. I worked on Capitol Hill. I was the chief minority counsel of the House Judiciary Committee. They're done by unanimous consent. The reason it wasn't done here by unanimous consent is because, first of all, the Democrats didn't agree with the change that the Senate was making in the House, and they wanted a full vote on it. The House didn't dare bring it up because they were going into the 2006 election and didn't think they could prevail on the floor with a lot of Republicans. So they passed something that is not really a law. It is out there on the books, and it's now going to be contested in court. I don't know how it's going to turn out. Mm. But this is, Diane, you hit a very good point. This book really addresses a lot of things where Republicans have refused to do what is called the regular order. They don't honor the processes of government that have been either constitutionally established by law, tradition, custom. These are what they're ignoring.
And do you believe that the American people care about process?
I do. In fact, I deal a good bit in here with the fact that why one of the reasons I did this book is because after writing a book about Bush's secrecy in 2004 called Worse Than Watergate, I was surprised during the Kerry campaign that they didn't talk about the secrecy at all. Other people were surprised. The editorial page of the New York Times, a lot of papers around the country. Why hadn't he raised the excessive secrecy? Well, I called the Kerry campaign and talked to the absolute top of the campaign, said, what happened to that issue? And I was told, well, this is a process issue. And process issues, people don't care about process issues. Well, I knew I cared about process issues. I knew a lot of people I talked to. I know a lot of journalists care about process issues. I also know that there is a feeling within this beltway by the pundits now that process isn't important, that people shouldn't be bothered with it, that we should all be looking at policy. Well, I think that's baloney, and I was actually able to find some solid, empirical, academic research that shows that somewhere 20-30% of the American people, registered voters in particular, care much about process. Now, they may not know what a motion to recommit is or a cloture vote in the Senate, but they do understand that they know the processes which are all there designed to protect the public interest. They know when they're getting the short end of the stick. And so they do understand this. It is important to them. And that's one of the points I make in this book, that the Democrats have got to, again, focus on process. One of the things that's happening in the primaries with a lot, the Democratic candidates, they're talking more process than they have in the past, but still it's heavily policy-oriented.
Here's a question for you from Joyce, who says it seems that both the Republican and Democratic parties are preoccupied in partisanship and campaigning rather than performing their duties in Congress, such as oversight of the executive branch. Do you think we're nearing time for a third political party?
I think it could happen. There's no question. There's great dissatisfaction with the existing parties. No really strong, charismatic third-party candidate has surfaced at this time. But I happen to think that the Democrats are, well, I'm not a Democrat, I think they're doing a much better job on oversight. The first 6 years of the Bush administration, the Republicans on Capitol Hill became an extension of the White House, facilitating and assisting and blessing and encouraging and aiding and abetting, if you will. Whereas now that the Democrats are in control, they are actually doing something called oversight, and to the great displeasure of the White House.
Do you believe, as many people do, that in fact it's been a Bush-Cheney presidency as opposed to a Bush presidency?
Very much so, and I've looked at this very closely. I have a number of pretty well-placed friends still who are very aware of what's happening, and I was first alerted to it during the transition in 2000 when the Supreme Court was yet to decide who would be in the White House. Cheney had taken charge of the transition, and he was clearly setting up the government the way he wanted it. Bush had delegated this to him. Bush doesn't care about these kind of nuts and bolts issues. Cheney knows this is that the process is the name of the game. The way you set up the machinery and the way you operate the machinery determines the outcome. And he's dominated this. He knows all the way. He set up, for example, a shadow National Security Council that was stronger than the statutory National Security Council. His people were running circles around Condoleezza Rice when she was National Security Director. So he has had a very strong influence. Bush has given him a portfolio of his his choice, and he has used it, and I think he's abused it. And he's taken that office, which is an office that is totally unaccountable in the constitutional system. It's only accountable to one person. That's the president. And this president doesn't particularly care if he knows even what all Cheney's doing.
Considering how far off track you believe our government has gone, all three branches, do you honestly believe that even if you have a Democrat in the White House and a democratically controlled Congress, how difficult is it going to be to get government back on track?
It's going to be very difficult. What happens is, and this happened during, this process didn't start just with Bush and Cheney. It really starts with Reagan. It really starts even earlier with Nixon, who doesn't get done what he wants to do. Reagan picks it up, and he's able to get a lot of it done. And Bush 1 does further. But when Clinton arrives in the White House, he finds a whole new set of tools that weren't there before. And indeed takes advantage of them. He, you know, it's very tempting for a president to take these newfound powers and use them. He didn't always do it in the way that the Republicans had in mind. For example, this concept of the unitary executive. The way it was put in by Reagan was to control the regulatory agencies, the independent regulatory agencies, to make them report into the Office of Management and Budget and to the White House staff so they could control what the regulatory agencies were doing, to cut back regulation, to give business less regulation. Well, you can also, when you have a unitary executive, do the reverse. You can put more controls on. Mm-hmm. And that's what Clinton was doing. He was very interested in health and safety, so he used it just the opposite direction.
27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. If you've just joined us, John Dean is here in the studio. He's written the second in a trilogy. It's titled Broken Government: How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. He says it is not a partisan book, that he is looking simply at the facts as he has studied them and reports them. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Stonington, Connecticut. Good morning, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Diane, what a pleasure to be on the air with you. And
thank
John,
you.
What a patriot. I can't thank you enough for your work. I obviously am very sympathetic to the ideas that you're trying to get out. I wish only that every single listener that ever listens to you, Diane, is listening today and telling a friend to podcast the show if they didn't get a chance to hear it. I'm curious, John, what you think about people like Cheney, Wolfowitz, you know, some of the people that were part of the project for the New American Century and their work leading into the Bush presidency, how influential think tanks like that were in changing the government in this rather scary direction. And I also wonder, I know you don't want to speculate about crimes committed, but many of us are convening in Washington tomorrow to call for a new 9/11 commission or a new investigation of the 9/11 attacks, because we believe that the commission, although it tried its best to do a good job, was so heavily dictated to by the White House that it was flawed from the get-go.
All right, Richard, thanks for your call. John Dean.
Let me give you my take on those two issues. First of all, no question that the so-called neoconservatives have had a tremendous influence on this presidency. The last book I did, a book called Conservatives Without Conscience, analyzed why Republicans are acting the way they are. And I ran into a body of research I didn't even know existed. And it's a study that started after World War II that studies the so-called authoritarian personality. Now, not all conservatives are authoritarians, but all authoritarians are conservative. And when I analyzed who's running and controlling the Republican Party, it's very clear it's under the control of authoritarians. You have two types of authoritarians, the leaders and you have the followers. The followers are those who submit easily and quickly, and whatever their leader tells them, they don't really ask any questions, and they just follow. They'll follow them right over the cliff. In fact, about 25% of the American public can be classified and has been by social scientists as authoritarian personalities, either leaders or followers. These are the people who are controlling the Republican Party and the government. This is the neoconservative philosophy is a very authoritarian philosophy. And there's no question it's had a big impact. And until people understand the way these people operate and the way they think, it will continue. And as I say, a lot of people who should otherwise be asking serious questions about these policies don't do so.
You make it sound nefarious from the get-go.
It was startling to me to discover this. And while it is troublesome, it's something we have to be very conscious of and deal with.
I misspoke earlier when I said that this was the second in John Dean's trilogy. Actually, it's the third. First was Worse Than Watergate, second, Conservatives Without Conscience, and now Broken Government. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University. Additional support comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the tortured relationship between Robert F. Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover in the 1960s. Writer Burton Hirsch says that as Attorney General, Kennedy tried to keep his FBI director on a short leash, but Hoover's knowledge of Kennedy family secrets gave him the upper hand. Hirsch has a new book. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
John Dean, before we go back to the phones, you write that the judiciary is the branch of government in the most trouble. Why do you believe that?
Well, it's a 40-year process. It's a process I actually witnessed from the time I was in the White House. It started with Nixon, who decided he was going to politicize the federal judiciary. Traditionally, was the non-political branch. Yes, all the presidents who have appointment power appoint people in a general who are sympathetic with their philosophy. But never has there been a conscious effort, as there was, say, in the 68 campaign, to promise voters that they would put a certain type of judge or justice on the Supreme Court. That's what Nixon started, and it's been unrelenting. Today we have a court that is, yes, conservative. There are clearly five members up there now who are conservative. Kennedy, who is a Republican, is somewhat of a swing vote. But it's swinging so far conservative to what I call a fundamentalist court. And this is a court that will rewrite the laws. Issues like church and state will be eliminated. The Bill of Rights won't apply to the states, only to the federal government. The fundamentalists have a very starkly different judicial outlook. And this is what's most troubling, because most people don't pay much attention to the courts. They're the branch that they have the least contact with. It's the least visible of the branches. Yet it is the one who really, it's the branch that is probably affecting Americans more than they can begin to realize. It affects the other two branches.
And you still, however, have individual judges ruling, for example, on portions of the Patriot Act, calling them unconstitutional.
Well, it's gotten, Diane, so I can tell a good deal about who appointed that judge by the nature of the ruling. That isn't the way it should be. You shouldn't be able to know whether he's a Republican appointee or a Democratic appointee, but that's now become just an absolute sure result. When somebody's protecting civil liberties, they're no doubt a Democratic appointee. If they don't care a hoot about them they just will give them the minimum attention, they're going to be a Republican appointee. I suspect that the most troublesome area will be that things like school prayer, and these are issues that are important to a lot of people, but they're unable to get the popular and the political branches to push them through because not a majority of Americans want it. Issues like abortion that are very tough issues. They are all going to be handled by a fundamentalist court if indeed another fundamentalist judge is added to that court. And that's what's going to happen if a Republican goes into the White House, because the fundamentalist the authoritarians that control the Republican Party are going to demand it. It's the quid pro quo.
Let's go now to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Dean. We Oklahomans send you a Profiles in Courage Bank bouquet.
Well, thank you.
And I wanted to just ask you one real quick question. Under the guise of law and order, we have a lot of anarchy creeping up on us. And speaking of law and order, we're being sold Fred Thompson as a gee shucks, down-home guy. And they're forgetting that he was a Watergate lawyer, which I think is, with apologies to you, pretty low. What do you remember about the real Fred Thompson? Thanks.
Yes, I do recall Fred well. In fact, the New York Times had a piece a couple of weeks ago by Joe Baker where she did a profile of Thompson, and I'd spoken to her during her research phase. And my first direct dealings with Thompson came when he started asking me a question. He said, "Now, Mr. Dean, I don't want you to think I'm beating up with you on these questions." And I responded to him, just really sort of testing him from the witness stand, and said, "Well, Mr. Thompson, if I was still at the White House as White House counsel, I'd be feeding you the questions to ask this fella who's sitting in the chair where I am now." And Thompson kind of took offense to that, said, "Well, I don't need those sort of questions given to me." Well, that, of course, was a falsehood. He was being fed everything from the White House. He had a direct pipeline to the White House, but he wasn't under oath. I was.
What kind of a presidential candidate do you regard him as?
It's going to be interesting. He has never been on the national stage. It's a much different game to play. It's not running for the Senate in Tennessee. He's going to be tested, and his mettle will be evident very quickly. He's got a certain appeal. Yes, he's been an actor, but you need more than a script to be out there and succeed. And it's the Republican Party is filled with factions. They are not happy with anybody right now. So it'll be curious to see. I don't know how he'll fare. I will say this. I think he's the least authoritarian.
That's what I was
of all of the
ask.
Personalities uh-huh. who are out there on the Republican side.
And yet strictly with very conservative views on issues, for example, like abortion or same-sex marriage or any of those social issues being debated.
Yes, I think he is. I think he's, in fact, the last time I saw Fred was in the green room of MSNBC, where I do a lot of commentary. And I was thinking, I said, you know, Fred, you're somebody, this was just about the time we all knew there was going to be a vacancy on the court. It's before Roberts and Alito were appointed, but Rehnquist was not in the best of health. And I said, Fred, you know, maybe I should get out there and thump the drum for you as somebody who could get through and be a fairly moderate judge. He's, John, just back off right now. Don't begin to suggest that I'm making some real money right now and I don't want to go on the court.
Interesting. Thanks for your call, Carol. Let's go now to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to take issue with with your guest here on a few things. He seems to suggest that the only fox in the henhouse is the Republican Party, and I would respectfully submit to you that Democrats got run out after 40 years of run because they were viewed by the electorate as ineffective legislators. You know, they solved poverty in the 60s. Oh, well, maybe they didn't solve it. They solved voting rights. Well, maybe they didn't solve that. Now, the Republicans suffered last time around because they're deemed to be ineffective. But to cast this all in a Republican light and say that there's some nefarious Republican plan to throw these people out, I think, is missing the boat. People are dissatisfied. That's true. But there are just as many skunks in the Democratic Party, and you do a disservice to take one side to the American people and to the discussion, because there's plenty of, and we're not going to belabor all the points, but you know as well as I do, there are as many issues and as many controversies and as many, again, foxes in the henhouse on the Democratic side.
Let me take the issue you have raised, because I've looked at a lot of those and tried to analyze and be fair in calling it the way I see it. Now, you say, yes, they, after 40 years of controlling the House, the Democrats lost and Republicans took over. How did they do that? Newt Gingrich took an attack on the House, the likes of which we've never seen, as a backbencher. He attacked the ethics of the Democrats. He forewarned the Republicans so they could get out of the way. They had people walking out on the floor of the House wearing one guy wearing a paper bag saying, I'm ashamed to be a member of this body. And they were relentless in tearing down the institution. They wanted to destroy the House. Listen, but wait, stay with me.
Hold on, Steve. I'll let you comment.
They wanted to destroy the institution. They didn't care the consequences. And they did destroy the institution. And that's how Republicans won, because it was believed by the Democrats couldn't run Congress anymore. Well, when you have that kind of attack and that kind of viciousness going on, they removed civility from the House, and people don't like that kind of conflict. That's where you can trace some of the severe incivility that has crept into Washington, is in those years.
Steve.
Well, you could certainly trace some incivility there, but that is, you know, that is, what the Republicans did was appeal to the electorate, and they won, and they outfoxed the Democrats, and they came at them hard. And, you know, you suggested earlier that senatorial ploys such as when you can hold up a bill. I'm drawing a blank on the name.
Filibuster.
A filibuster had never been used by Democrats. You know that's not true. That's disingenuous to suggest that. And all I'm saying to you,
well, they happened to Democrats who most effectively used it happened to have been conservative Democrats who would now all be in the Republican Party. They were the ones who tied up civil rights legislation during the entire time I was on Capitol Hill. And that's been a very conservative tactic. In fact, the Republicans were the first to ever filibuster a Supreme Court nomination.
Last comment, Steve.
Well, that's kind of convenient to call Democrats who filibustered Republicans now. I mean, that's just, I mean, that's my point. I am not some screaming right-wing person that can't see this equally.
And I'm not a screaming left-wing.
But you're throwing a whole lot more on the Republican Party, and you're doing it through innuendo and words like nefarious and why they're neoconservatives, and these words that are couched in some sort of secret meaning, wink, wink, nod, nod. And in fact, that's, you know, when you talked about the judiciary earlier, people are upset with the judiciary because in Alabama you can't display the Ten Commandments in the courthouse where they've always been. It's decisions like that. This is not rocket science stuff that upsets the electorate. It's guys who can no longer afford to give their employees health care insurance. They're fairly simple issues that upset people that go to the polls. You answered a question earlier about a third party coming, and it probably will be coming because the Democrats, talk about being handed a layup situation. They've got their whole party behind them, and they're not sure they're even going to win this election.
All right, Steve, thanks for your call. Doesn't he have a point there that despite the fact that we are at war, despite the dissatisfaction among the electorate with the war, that there are no real assurances that Democrats are going to, number one, win the White House, and number two, do something effective about the war?
Well, I agree with both of those. And I don't disagree with a lot of things the caller says, because he's taking impressions from sound bites. That's why one writes books about these things, where they can lay it out chapter and verse and explain, you know, the evidence, and let the reader then decide for themselves if indeed I have made the case I am offering. I'll be very curious to see, because I'm somebody who spends a lot of time researching. These aren't my opinions. They're based on a fairly careful and full sifting of the evidence. And if the reader still felt that way afterwards, I'd love to know where I got something wrong.
Mm. And now to Woodstock, Illinois. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning. I just wanted to first of all say that many people assume that Mr. Bush expanded his presidential powers in order to go to war, scripting it as the commander-in-chief concept, therefore sounding quite legal. I assumed all along the reverse, that he actually went to war in order to expand his presidential powers. And the clue to much of this is actually in the Nixon Frost interview, I believe it was 1977, 78, it could have been taped. And in that interview, Mr. Nixon says openly, he says, as long as the president is at war, he can break the law and ignore the Constitution. I also think that Wiseman Kissinger, who attended Crawford, Texas prior to 2000 and was a consultant for Mr. Bush and is also the consultant currently, has his fingerprints all over this process.
All right, Lydia, thanks for your call. At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How do you respond to those comments, John?
I think they're good points. They're points well taken. One of the things that I did in assembling this material, as I say, I didn't try to look at it from, you know, the partisan angle. I traced the history. There's no question Kissinger's fine hand was involved in a lot of the Bush foreign policy. The reader's comment about Nixon's famous remark to David Frost that when the president does it, it's not illegal, has really become a norm in the Bush-Cheney presidency. And they are open about it. Rather than try to do it at the dark of night or behind covers, they just openly violate the law. We know that they have pushed the law. We've seen some of the memos that emerged that support torture. We've seen some of the stuff that supports illegal wiretapping. That's fairly blatant. I actually deconstruct a little bit of that to show John Yoo, who was one of the principal legal scholars, his style and how he distorts information and misuses information, mischaracterizes the arguments of the people he is opposing. And it's shoddy scholarship, but it gets it, and to base a war on this kind of thinking is pretty dangerous.
One last quick comment from Kathleen in Athens, Ohio. Good morning to you.
Hi, Mr. D. Dean, I go to John Dean Fine Law all the time and read and link your articles all over the blogosphere. So thank you for your professional insights. But you've written about the impeachment of lower-level Bush administration officials. So can Ari Fleischer-Rove and others who outed Valerie Plame Wilson still be impeached? And can Douglas Feith, Wolfowitz, and others who created and manipulated false WMD intelligence still be impeached? And if a president can be impeached for lying under oath about extramarital hanky-panky, why can't the president and VP be impeached for an intelligence snow job that has resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths and millions of refugees?
They can be impeached. The question is whether the House would do so. And Nancy Pelosi has taken impeachment off the table for the president and probably the vice president. I wouldn't be surprised if there is some preliminary action that might come out of the Judiciary Committee on the U.S. attorney's firing, if there has been some real serious abuse that pops up. So we don't have the end of this story yet.
John Dean, his new book, the third in his trilogy, is titled Broken Government, How Republican Rule Destroyed the Legislative, Executive, and Judicial Branches. Thanks so much for being here.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Emmanuel Tui. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.